woke up, but his mouth was still dry. Kay studied him. "Were you out late last night? Did you just get up?" He shook his head. "Sure. Like I remember you getting up at the crack of dawn over summer vacation."
"You know me,"
Daniel said. "I like to rise with the sun." "Get a head start on the farm, right?" Peter stirred sugar into his coffee.
"How is Roland doing these days?"
When Daniel had woken up, 40 minutes ago, after a few hours of negligible sleep, his coat was folded at the foot of the couch and Roland's bedroom door was closed. They hadn't seen each other since he had run out of the show. He spoke through his teeth, tilting his sentences upwards.
"Great! We played a show last night."
As he cut his omelet, his elbow bumped against Kay's. "Last night? Was it in a bar?"
"Mom, I haven't been doing anything. A beer or two now and then."
"You know what they say. Temptations can lead to relapses. You should be at home with us. Going to meetings. You are going to meetings, aren't you?" She asked him the same thing each time they spoke, and he always lied.
"The one near Roland's place. I told you about it."
He'd seen the letter that had arrived from the dean at the end of last semester. The bold print detailing the terms of his academic dismissal. After his spring semester GPA fell to a 1.9, the school had put him on probation. And in October, he stopped going to classes. Peter had installed blocking software on Daniel's laptop, though the poker sites had already banned him after he overdrew too many accounts. His knee knocked against the table, sloshing Kay's tea out of its cup, and Peter watched as he mopped the liquid with his napkin.
"I'm doing good here. I'm making decent money at my job. Not using my credit card. And Roland's roommate is moving out in May, so I'm going to take his bedroom. It's not like Potsdam, where there's nothing to do. I'm too busy to get distracted by that stuff here."
"Nothing to do in Potsdam, he says." Peter huffed.
"It's school. You're supposed to be studying. That's what you're supposed to be doing. Not all this stuff."
"I don't know," Kay said. "These addictions. I've been reading about it. They go beyond self-policing. And New York City is so full of temptations."
"Trust me, Mom."
"There are bad elements everywhere, yes. But there are more people in New York City. More chances to run into bad elements."
"Working in a Mexican restaurant like a common laborer," Peter said.
"Don't be racist,"
Daniel said.
"What? It's racist now to say Mexican? Well, you serve tacos and refried beans. If that's not Mexican, I don't know what is. Call a spade a spade."
"A spade? Are you serious? The owners are rich and white, so you have nothing to be worried about. All kinds of people work there. All races and ages. Why, I even have an Indian co-worker who's at FIT, and a black co-worker who's going to NYU. And the owners didn't go to college, and they're fucking millionaires. I haven't met them because they don't even live in New York. One guy lives in a treehouse in Washington State, his brother's surfing in Costa Rica, and the other guy's in Berlin."
Peter said nothing, scooped up forkfuls of Eggs Benedict.
"Daniel," Kay said. "Don't talk to your father like that."
"Enough of this," Peter said. "No more beating around the bush. We didn't drive 5 hours to listen to his sarcasm."
"We have good news," Kay said. "Great news. Carlo College is willing to take you as a student. Starting this summer. You can make up the credits you missed. It'll be on a provisionary basis, of course."
Peter and Kay had wanted Daniel to go to Carlo.
where they could get him a faculty tuition cut, but had relented to his choice of SUNY Potsdam as long as he promised not to take music classes. His financial aid and work-study income had been enough to cover tuition when his grades were decent, and Potsdam had been far enough upstate that Daniel could hide out, not be solely known as Roland's friend. "But I'm here now. I have a place to live."
"Roland's sofa is not a place to live," Peter said.
Daniel took a long sip of water. "I don't want to go to Carlo."
"You should have thought of that before you got expelled from Potsdam."
"I don't want to go anywhere. I want to be here."
"Your mother and I have put ourselves on the line for you. We succeeded at getting you into Carlo despite the misgivings of the dean, which were, honestly, quite warranted. She saw the dismissal. Your transcript. We had to bend over backwards to convince her you deserved another chance. Your ingratitude is simply astounding."
Kay placed her palm on Daniel's wrist. "I know it's been a difficult time. But you cannot quit after 2 years of college. What are you going to do without a degree?"
"Play music." "Play music!"
A flush spread across Peter's forehead.
"Don't be foolish. Is music going to pay your rent? Buy your groceries?"
Peter had been saying the same thing since Daniel was 12 years old.
"Roland didn't finish college and he's doing fine," Daniel said,
neglecting to mention that Roland was taking business classes at night.
"His roommate Adrian's in his third year of college and already has $100,000 in student loans." "This is madness."
Kay rummaged through her tote bag, removed a bundle of papers, and passed them to Daniel.
"March 15, Peter said. 3 weeks away. That is the deadline for you to fill out this application in order to matriculate at Carlo for the summer. The website for the online form is printed out here. I would write the statement of purpose for you myself if it wasn't ethically wrong. Don't think I haven't considered it. But do not mistake this for a choice."
Peter had already filled out the first page with Daniel's name and their address in Ridgeboro. Daniel folded the forms and put them in his pocket.
"What if I enroll in Carlo in the fall? Or transfer to a school in the city? There are more job opportunities here. Networking opportunities. I need a few months off. When I do go back to school, I'll be healthy. Focused."
"I don't think so," Kay said.
"One semester off is already too much," Peter said. "You're in danger of falling behind. Now, if it were up to me, we would be taking you home with us after this meal. But your mother seems to believe that you can take care of yourself."
"Well," Kay said.
"I am. You have nothing to worry about. We'll get the forms from you next weekend. A copy of your statement of purpose. And after that, you will send us a confirmation of your submitted application." "Next weekend?"
"We'll be in the city again," Kay said. "Jim Hennings is turning 60 and having a party on Saturday night. Angel will be there. You'll join us, of course." Daniel's muscles contracted. So Angel hadn't gone to Nepal. If they were still friends, if she was still talking to him, he would tell her about Michael's email, about Peter's accusation of ingratitude. How torn he felt between anger and indebtedness. If only Peter and Kay knew how much he wanted their approval. How he feared disappointing them like he'd disappointed his mother. Angel had once told him that she felt like she owed her parents. "But we can't make ourselves miserable because we think it'll make them happy," she had said.
That's a screwed-up way to live.
Daniel had known her since they were kids. But their long, insomniac phone calls had only started last spring. And for most of last year, she had been his greatest consolation. Her sincerity was contagious. And he liked hearing about her friends and crushes, her plans for the summer, the classes she liked and the ones she didn't, how living in the Midwest was calmer and quieter than Manhattan. Sometimes the silence still spooked her. But God, she would kill for a decent slice of pizza. A lamb shawarma in a pita. Kay motioned to the waitress for the check. We love you. We want the best for you. I know it doesn't seem like that right now, but we do.
You'll see it someday.
Peter pushed his chair away from the table.
Where's the bathroom?
Daniel watched Peter walk across the restaurant. A new stiffness in his shoulders and legs. Guilt sank through him. They wanted him to succeed in the ways that were important to them because it would mean that they had succeeded too. Roland had been too busy to talk to him for a year, but Kay and Peter called each week. How could he hurt them more than he already had? He could never return Michael's email. He turned back to Kay. I'll fill out the application, Mom. After a 7-hour shift at Tres Locos, Daniel's wrists were sore from bean scooping, pepper chopping, and burrito wrapping. On Roland's kitchen table was an empty box for a Neumann microphone, and Daniel picked up the receipt and let out a low whistle. The mic had cost $2,000. He removed the Carlo College forms, now crumpled after being in his pocket, and left them on the counter. The couch pulled out into a bed where he slept, his backpack and guitars stashed at its feet. Roland's roommate Adrian was either working or at school or at his girlfriend's place, and Roland was mostly out as well, taking classes, transporting art, working on a construction crew for gallery installations, modeling for a designer friend, helping friends in other bands. Daniel sank onto the couch and took his guitar out. Despite his sore wrists, he wanted to work on a song. He heard keys in the door, and before he could put his guitar away, Roland came in.
What are you playing?
Just fooling around, Daniel said. They looked at each other.
Listen.
Roland shifted his weight from one foot to the other.
I want you to know I'm not mad or anything.
I didn't say you were.
We'd barely practiced.
I'm sorry.
Come listen to something I did today.
Daniel sat on Roland's bed as Roland opened Pro Tools on his computer. A line trickled out. Roland's voice. A Psychic Heart song. Roland pressed a button. It was the same line, but altered with plug-in effects to sound scratched up, scuzzified. Daniel didn't get it. It was using cheesy CGI effects in a historical film. A bad vintage photo filter.
Hutch, the Jupiter Booker, is into this shit,
Roland said.
After you left last night, I ended up talking to him about the bands he's worked with. You know he helped Jane Russ blow up, right? And Terraria. Brutal percussion. Guitars in overdrive. Now they're huge. I'm thinking Psychic Heart should go in this direction.
You want to change the band for Hutch?
I want to play Jupiter. I want to get signed.
What about your own music? You don't even care? Roland shrugged.
Art evolves.
Oh, give me a fucking break!
We don't have to.
Roland hit pause.
But we should.
It's not like Hutch is going to book us after last night anyway.
Nah, I talked to him. And Javier's playing a show in a few weeks. Nothing big. But we can have one of the opening slots.
With the new sound. That Hutch likes. Yeah, of course.
Still, Daniel was closer to it than ever before.
The oldest burrito wrapper at Tres Locos, a red-haired white guy named Evan who dropped frequent mentions about how New York had been so much cooler and more dangerous in the 90s, was 36 and still trying to get his band off the ground. Daniel had gone to see Evan open for 4 other acts on a Tuesday night, and the guy could barely sing. At work today, when Daniel mentioned he'd played the loft party, omitting the part where he had run away, Evan had said,
"Get the hell out of here!"
and plopped down a spoonful of Pintos with such force bean juice had splattered his chest.
If Psychic Hearts played Jupiter, he would be sure to invite Evan.
In high school, Roland used to tell the other kids,
"You have to see Daniel play."
And if they did a show and no one said anything, Daniel would fall into a funk. Consider tossing his guitar in the trash. But when people called him amazing, he basked in it. Couldn't sleep. Reviewing the compliments over and over in his mind. He wanted to be complimented again. To be called amazing.
"Okay," he said. "The new sound. We should record at Dad's studio. The one that does cassette demos. This summer, after we have a few more songs. Or even before."
Roland had ferried a crate of his parents' old 80s tapes down from Ridgeboro. The ones he and Daniel had once studied like they'd been unearthed from a Paleolithic cave, and were now as bewilderingly valuable as the rarest, most pristine vinyl. Daniel had to admit there was an oddly comforting quality about tape's crusty, decaying sound. A sincerity. A depth that digital couldn't reach.
"Sure,"
he said. This summer, he would be going to classes at Carlo, living in his old room in Ridgeboro. He wouldn't be playing music at all.
"Where'd your parents go? To a hotel?"
"They went home. By now they would be back in that big, cold house, reading in bed." He fiddled with his sweatshirt.
"Oh,
I got a strange email a while back. From this guy I'd grown up with. When I lived with my mother. My birth mom. Before I came to Ridgeboro."
"What did it say?"
"He said he had something to tell me about my mom. I didn't write him back. But I'm a little curious." Daniel knew what Roland's response would be before he even said it.
"Don't do it. You'll regret it."
On the topic of parental ghosts, Roland was dependable. Unwavering. His own father had died when Roland was too young to remember. And he'd never shown interest in learning more. Daniel craved Roland's decisiveness for himself. He had always wished he could be so sure. He picked up the Carlo application forms and put them back down. He returned to his guitar, played the refrain that had been bouncing around earlier, reshaped it, scribbled a few lines, then pictured Kay's face, teary, as he told her he had found out what happened to his real mom. The song slipped away. Thinking of his mother brought a low, persistent ache in a spot he could never get to. He put his guitar away and picked up his laptop. Just a quick search. Peter and Kay would never know. In junior high, he had done these searches every few months. Until the urge to know more had fallen away. He had stopped searching after realizing he was averting his gaze while scrolling through the results. Relieved to never find the right one. Not knowing more excused him from having to change the life he had gotten accustomed to. And it had been years since he had searched for Michael Chen. Michael's name had always been too popular, with nearly 500,000 results. Or Polly Guo. Or Guo Pei Lan, in English or even in Chinese characters, which never brought up anything matching his mother. He had never found the right Leon or Vivian Zheng. But tonight, he typed in Michael Chen and Columbia and pulled up a website for a university biology lab, scrolled down the page and saw Michael's name and a headshot of a lanky guy, smug and happy in a dark shirt. Michael's face was longer and he didn't wear glasses anymore, but Daniel could see the kid version there, the wide-eyed 10-year-old who would go anywhere with him, the closest thing he'd ever had to a brother. Someone who had known Deming. He shut the laptop screen as if it were on fire. If Michael had information about his mother, it wouldn't change the fact that she had left him. Roland was right. There was no need to stir up bad memories. He paced the living room, the kitchen, toyed with the box for the microphone, imagined Roland on stage at Jupiter as he sat in a college lecture hall. He couldn't make Roland and Peter and Kay happy at the same time. But he might as well try. 3. She promised she'd never leave him again on the day they found their doppelgangers. Back then, 6-year-old Deming and his mother were still strangers to each other, but formed a satisfying pair. The same wide noses and curly smiles. Big, dark pupils underlined with slivers of white. A bit of lazy in their gaze. Her hand was foreign in his. He was used to his grandfather's warmer grip and more deliberate walk. His mother was too fast. Too loud. Like the American city he'd been dumped back into. And Deming missed the village. Its muted gradients of grass and water. Greens and blues. Burgundies and grays. New York City was shiny, sharp, with riots of colors, and everywhere the indecipherable clatter of English. His eyes ached, his mouth filled with noise. The air was so cold it hurt to inhale, and the sky was crammed with buildings. He'd sought comfort in something familiar. He heard melodies in everything. And with them saw colors, his body gravitating to rhythm the way a plant arched up to the light. Crossing Bowery, he felt the soothing repetition of his feet hitting the sidewalk, his left hand connected to his mother's right, his 2 steps to her every one. She launched into the crosswalk. It was her 1 day off in 2 weeks. Deming examined the sidewalk droppings, cigarette butts and smeary napkins, and, exposed between chunks of ice, so much gum. Who chewed these gray-pink wads? He had never chewed gum, and neither had his mother, to his knowledge, or any of her 6 roommates in their apartment on Rutgers Street. This was before they moved in with Leon, before the University Avenue apartment in the Bronx. They stood before the subway map with its long, noodly lines. "So what color should we do today?" she asked. Deming studied the words he couldn't read, the places he'd yet to go, and pointed to purple. He'd been born here, in Manhattan, Chinatown, but his mother had sent him to live with his grandfather when he was 1 year old, in the village where she had grown up. And it was Yigong who starred in Deming's earliest memories, who called him Little Fatty and taught him how to paddle a boat, collect a chicken egg, and gut a fish with the tip of a rusty knife. There were other children like him in Minjiang, American-born, cared for by grandparents, with parents they only knew from the telephone. "I'll send for you," the voice would say. But why would he go live with a voice? Leave what he knew for a person he didn't remember. All he had was a picture, where he was a scowling baby and his mother's face was obscured by a shadow. Each morning he awoke to ch-ch-ch-ch, Yigong sweeping the front of their house on 3 Alley. Yigong's wheezing, silver smoke rings dissolving skyward. Until the morning, Yigong didn't wake up. And then Deming was on a plane next to an uncle he would never see again. And a woman was hugging him in a cold apartment full of bunk beds. Her face only familiar because it resembled his. He wanted to go home, and she told him the bunk bed was home. He didn't want to listen. But she was all he had. That was 2 weeks ago. Now he sat in a classroom every day at a school on Henry Street, not understanding anything his teacher said, while his mother sewed shirts at a factory. 2 transfers later, and the Purple Line was running above ground, and Deming and his mother looked out the window at signs and languages they didn't recognize. "This one's for socks," he said, pretending to read. "That one's for dogs." Near the end of the line, the signs switched to Chinese, and his mother read each one out to him in a funny voice, deep and low, like a radio announcer.
"Going out of business! Immigration troubles? We cure bunions!"
He liked her like this. He could trust that she was his. He kicked his legs in the air as she slapped her thighs in a giddy beat. They had traveled to Queens, from one Chinese neighborhood to another. And when they emerged from the subway, the buildings were lower and the streets wider. But the crowds and the languages were similar. And despite the cold air, Deming could smell familiar aromas of vegetables and fish. It was a frigid, hard bite of a winter afternoon. Stopping at a corner, she introduced a new game. There could be a Mama and Deming who live here too. Another version of us. Like a best friend, but better. Like a brother. A cleaved self. They chose the building this Mama and Deming would live in. A short one with a flat front like theirs on Rutgers Street. And watched mothers and children walk along the sidewalk until they found a boy Deming's age and a woman his mother's height. Her hair also cut short so it settled in wisps against her chin. Like his mother, she wore a navy blue coat, and could be mistaken for her son's older sister. "Can't we ask them to come over?"
"We shouldn't disturb them. They're busy.
But let's watch them, okay?" She steered him into a bakery, and he begged for an egg tart. In those days, you could buy 3 for $1. But she refused, said it was a waste of money. And they sat at a table without buying anything, examining their doppelgangers through the window. The boy leaned up to his mother, and she bent down to talk to him as they crossed the street. In the boy's palm was a glazed, puffy object. A flaky yellow pastry. "Can I have an egg tart? Please?"
"No, Deming."
He pouted. Sometimes Yigong had let him guzzle cokes for breakfast, but she never bought him anything.
"I want to meet them."
He stomped his boot on the floor. Again she said no. He tore down the sidewalk after them.
"Wait!"
he yelled. They turned around. They knew Fujonese. The other Mama was older and skinnier, and the other Deming was 8 or 9 and not 5 or 6. Square-faced and squinty-eyed like the kind of boy who might light bugs on fire for kicks. A fat crumb of pastry dangled from his bottom lip. In the moment before his mother yanked him away, Deming met the other Deming's eyes, and the other Deming said, in English,
"Hi."
Then they walked off, fading into a sea of winter coats.
"They're gone," Deming said. "They left."
Frightened, he longed for Yigong.
"Are you ever going to leave me again?"
"Never." His mother took his hand and swung it up and down. "I promise I'll never leave you." But one day, she did. By July, Deming's mother had been gone for 5 months. Ever since the February day she disappeared, he had been waiting for a sign that she'd be back. Even a sign that she was gone forever, The summer was one big dead-end sign. The city had been too hot for weeks. The sofa's upholstery sweaty against Deming's thighs during the long, overheated afternoons. He and Michael batted their faces against the rattling plastic fan and sang, "La, lee, la, lee, la." The vibrations taking their words and spitting them out in a watery brown croak. They melted ice cubes in glasses and sucked on them. Dug into cushions to search for forgotten change for Mr. Softy runs. The ice cream always a letdown. Soggy orange sugar that soaked into its cardboard shell before Dumming even got his tongue in. The rest of the school year had been a derailing. Principal Scott said Dumming could go on to sixth grade if he went to summer school and made up the subjects he had failed. But Dumming didn't feel like going. "If you don't go, you'll be left back," Michael said. They sat on a metal railing, a row of benches below. Even Crotona Pool, which they'd gone to last summer with their friends, had lost its appeal. "Fuck this summer," Dumming said, tasting the pleasing heft of the words. "Fuck you." "Fuck you, too!" Michael's consonants were resonant with spit. "Don't you want to graduate high school?" "That was not my plan," Dumming heard his mother saying. "Fuck a plan." He contemplated the drop-off to the street. An odor of rot mingled with more familiar scents. Flatulent exhaust and sweet garbage. Searing pavement and grass. Pot smoke and perfume. Somewhere a barbecue. "Dare you to jump down," he said. Michael laughed without making a sound.
"It's not far. I'll make you jump."
Dumming sat with his knees bunched up, jabbing his chin into the air like Leon did when he knew you were full of shit.
"No one's making me do anything."
"We'll all be in sixth grade and you'll be stuck in fifth."
"Shut up."
Dumming slid off the railing.
On West 184th, Michael trotting alongside him, they passed Sopheap's building, the same as all the others on the block, squat and brown or taller and gray. The windows full of other families, the sidewalks noisy with other kids. They paused and observed the window where the same plastic blinds hung, the ones they had seen so many times from the inside of Sopheap's apartment. But that summer it seemed like their friends had never existed. That they, like Dumming's mother, had vanished with no guarantee of return. Elroy was visiting his aunt in Maryland. Hung was at a relative's upstate. And Sopheap, that traitor, had promised he'd be home all summer but had decamped at first opportunity to outermost Queens, where his cousin allegedly had a large-screen television and lived in a building full of hot chicks. Last time Michael and Dumming had seen Sopheap, 4 days or 6 weeks ago or whenever it was, Sopheap had described the peekaboo bra strap exposed on the shoulder of the hottest chick, how close she had sat to him while they watched TV. She smelled, he said, of bubblegum and pepperoni pizza. And Michael and Dumming had hooted and said Sopheap was full of crap. How come he never invited them to Outermost Queens? Instead of hot chicks, Sopheap might be spending the days with his grandma, who had moly arms and a long yellow tooth that caused her to fling saliva as she barked away at the boys in Khmer, slapping her slippers against their shoulder blades to get them to sit up straight. Everything was suspect. Had Sopheap's family ever lived there in the first place? Would Elroy and Hung even show up for school at the end of the summer? What happened to his mother? Nothing, no one, was certain anymore. Michael and Dumming stood in the space beneath the overhead tracks and hurled curse words into the subway's rattle. A car bumped past, blaring a bass line in rich, glossy maroons,
and a slow ache spread in the center of Deming's chest. Before his mother disappeared, he and Michael had been united in the secrets they kept from their moms, like filching a can of beer from Leon's 12-pack. Michael had grimaced and belched as they drank, and Deming had knocked back more. They had giggled, teetered. Another time they stole a pair of panties out of a cart at the laundromat across the street from Elroy's building, and in Elroy's room ran their hands over the tiny cotton panel where an actual girl's actual crotch had actually nestled, held it to their noses, sniffing exaggeratedly, saddened yet relieved when they smelled only detergent. Hong laid the panties on the bed, and the boys stared at the scrap of pinkish fabric, until Elroy plucked them up and smuggled them into his closet.
"I'll keep them here," he said, "for safekeeping."
Deming said they might not even belong to a hot girl, but to the woman who sat in front of Elroy's building and rubbed her fingers into her ponytail after scratching her hairy armpits. The other boys yelped in horror. Michael's shriek the loudest and highest. Now the only mother in the apartment was Vivian. And the fact that Deming's mother was gone was no secret. It was a car alarm cutting through an empty street in the middle of the night. He could curse as much as he wanted, but the words tasted like they had gone rotten in his mouth. He tried to remember as much as he could about her. Such a brief time when she had belonged to him alone. She cuffed her jeans twice so they wouldn't drag on the ground. She pulled the sleeves of her sweaters down like oversized mittens. The pleasing incongruity to her cackle. How she'd pinch the fat under his arms and call him a meatball. The delicate prettiness to her features. You had to hunt for her beauty. Might not even catch it at first. There was a sweetness to her mouth. Her lips lightly upturned, lending her a look of faint amusement. And her eyebrows arched so her eyes appeared lively, approaching delighted. He looked away so Michael wouldn't see the tears that came so fast he almost let them fall. They turned the corner. "Deming?" Michael sounded hesitant, like he was talking to a teacher or a friend's mom. "Did you hear? Travis Bopa's moving to Pennsylvania."
"So?"
Deming didn't know where Pennsylvania was. His mom left his dad for another man, and now he's got to go live with his grandma.
"What other man?"
"Some neighbor." Deming dug his fingernails into his arm. 10 sharp half-moons sparking pain. But what if she wasn't dead?
"That sucks," he said. "For Travis."
They ate dinner at the folding table in the kitchen. The plastic top printed to look like wood. A corner peeling and exposing a foamy underlayer. Deming snatched a piece of chicken from Vivian's plate. She tried to grab it.
"Stop it! Bad boy!"
Vivian's fat was rearranging itself. Her belly and arms were thinner, but extra skin had appeared beneath her chin and around her mouth, like plaster hastily slapped on top of an existing structure. She huffed when she walked upstairs, no longer danced to music on the radio, and fell asleep at the table. Gave the boys food and claimed she wasn't hungry. Deming had seen her look in her wallet and curse. And when he opened the refrigerator, she yelled at him to shut it. He heard her and Leon fighting about the rent. Who would watch the kids? He licked the chicken before she could get to it, ran his tongue up and down the salty skin. Leon glared at Deming and passed Vivian the rest of his food. Leon looked like hell. Reminded Deming of pictures of cavemen in a school textbook, standing straight and de-haired into upright Homo sapiens. Leon, after Mama, was reverse order evolution. He had developed a stoop, a paunch, a spotty beard specked with gray, It scared Deming. Like Leon had aged 100 years while other people remained the same. Once, riding the Staten Island ferry with his mother and Leon, the wind had stung his face, but he felt warm, as if nothing could go wrong. His mother had said,
"Do you like this boat, kid? Isn't it better than Yi Gong's fishing boat?"
And Leon had laughed, a belly chuckle that made Deming feel like he'd outrun the other kids at the playground. Now he couldn't recall the last time he had heard Leon laugh. Had Mama left, refused to marry Leon, because Leon got ugly? Deming chewed chicken. They had a lot of neighbors. Mrs. Johnson. Tommy, not bad, not bad, not bad. Miss Marie with the baby girl. There was the bodega owner, Eduardo, who'd been asking,
"I haven't seen your mother lately. How's she been?"
Deming would say, "Good. Busy." Eduardo's always asking how Mama is. Deming watched Leon for a reaction.
"Who?"
"The guy at the bodega." Leon's face was blank. Deming tried again. "I saw Tommy the other day." No answer. "Iba, can we go to Florida?" He had never referred to anyone but Leon as his father. And when his mother had first told him he could call Leon Iba, it had seemed a little illicit. In school, spacing out as the teacher chalked the multiplication table, trying to ignore the other kids who were hyped on sugar and rocking back and forth, busting out in Tourette's-y curse strings. One particularly restless kid liked to chant, "Balls, titties, balls, balls, titties," all day. Deming would mouth his words, "Iba, can you come here? Iba, can I watch TV?" Leon looked up.
"Florida? Why?"
"If Mama's there, we're not trying hard enough to find her. What if she's in danger?"
"She's not in danger."
"But how do you know?"
"I know. She'll call soon."
"Mom?" Michael asked. "Can we go to Florida?"
"No,"
Vivian said. "I want to go to Disney World," Michael said.
"No, no, no, no."
As Deming scooped rice out of the pot, a clump fell on the table.
"Don't waste food!"
Vivian swept the spilled rice onto her plate and took his bowl away. "Maybe your mama left because she was tired of feeding such an ungrateful boy." She took Deming's plate to the sink.
"Don't listen to her,"
Leon said.
"She didn't leave because of you. We're all going to stay together. You and me and your mama. We just have to wait."
Vivian said,
"I'm going to the store."
Leon went to work. Michael fell into the couch like it was eating him. Deming didn't know what he was doing here. Leon wasn't his real Yiba. Michael and Vivian not his real cousin and aunt. If his mother ran away with another man, he had to let her know that she couldn't get rid of him that easily. He grabbed clothes and stuffed them in a plastic bag.
"Stop blocking the TV," Michael said. "I'm going to Florida to find my mom."
Laughter from the studio audience rattled out. Michael stared at Deming, his eyes enormous behind his glasses.
"Then I'll go too." "Are you serious?"
"Of course. We're brothers, right?"
"Like brothers." "Okay, then we have to hurry."
Deming dumped a ball of Michael's clothes into the bag.
"We have to go now."
He took his keys, tossed Michael's shoes at him, and they moved out the door.
"How are we going?"
Michael shouted as Deming ran up University, taking a right on 192nd. He didn't know which store Vivian had gone to, which block she'd take back to the apartment.
My shoelace!
I have a plan,
Deming said.
Though he didn't. As they neared the subway station, they heard a train pulling away, and they ducked into the stairwell, panting.
I don't have a metro card, Michael said.
Deming swung the bag of clothing against his leg. It was heavier than he'd expected.
Me neither. I'm going to tie my shoelace now.
Michael bent down, tied one loop, then another.
I don't have any money,
Deming whispered.
We can ask my mom, maybe.
She won't let you go if you ask her.
Michael looked so serious, so trusting. He couldn't ask Michael to leave Vivian. Then they would both be without mothers.
Let's go home.
What about Florida?
Another time.
They turned back.
I'm hungry,
Michael said. Inside the bodega, Deming lingered in the aisles, fingering a candy bar. But Eduardo's bushy white beard kept catching his eye.
Whew!
Eduardo whistled from behind the cash register. A giant metal fan batted warm air around.
The stinking heat!
It's a heat wave, Michael said.
How's your mama doing? She all right?
She's great, Deming said. And we're late for dinner.
They walked out with nothing. By the time they got to their building, his arm ached. He asked Michael,
You seen Tommy lately?
Not for a while.
They paused outside Tommy's door. Deming wanted to kick it, but it didn't sound like anyone was inside.
Where's Pennsylvania anyway?
Real far.
Deming could see the relief in Michael's face when they got home. He brought the bag of clothes to the bedroom, unpacked as quietly as he could, and heard Michael saying,
We went for a walk, Mom.
Mom.
Deming fell asleep on the couch, woke to drool caked on the side of his face. Much later, after Leon came home, the sky cracked open and it rained, drops splattering against fire escapes, running down rooftops, giving the air conditioners a free bath. A slow, humid breeze trickled into the bedroom, Michael's limbs flailing in a distant dream. Deming watched Leon sleep, the rise and fall of Leon's chest, pressing his arm against Leon's back. He needed Leon to stay. But they were safe. For now. Humbled and seething. They were two men without her.
Leon said it was no big deal. That his woman had split and nobody knew where she was.
He made a little laugh. A joke.
She left me. Isn't that crazy?
But Deming saw how the skin on his neck was droopy and crinkled. Deep brown circles blooming under his eyes like a wet cup on a paper plate.
I'll get another woman, you hear?
Leon said, sitting at the kitchen table in the dark. The summer dragged on. Deming heard Leon and Vivian talking, hid in the other room so they wouldn't know he was listening. At work, a falling hog had smacked Leon and he skidded on the slick floor, coming to on his back. Got probation. He sliced the wrong veins, let an animal drift on like a graceful ocean liner, large, crooked knife slashes against the meat grain. He was given the second of three strikes. His hours docked. The landlord had already given two extensions for late rent. The loan sharks men were less understanding. Mama's co-worker, Didi, Leon's buddy Guan's wife, had called screaming about the nail salon, how the boss had been involved in something shady.
Do you think she went to Florida?
Vivian said. But Didi had tracked down the number of the restaurant, and when Leon called, the owners said Mama never showed up. Didi had called the police, immigration, and they said there was no record of her. So Mama was okay. Not in danger like Dumming had feared. Just took off on her own. Leon told Vivian he'd gone to a lawyer, one Guan had found, whom Guan had to help translate. Back home, Guan would be a freak, an American-born Vietnamese-Chinese who could only speak a drop of Chinese, but here, Guan was a big shot, because of his English. And here Leon was a nobody, because of his Chinese. It drove Leon crazy that he needed Guan, a little guy with a big voice who spiked his hair into mini spears. Leon had wanted to belt the lawyer when he asked,
"Did she know anyone? Any other men? You might think you know a woman and you don't."
When Guan translated, Leon said,
"Tell him to go suck his own cock."
Vivian said they couldn't keep bothering the police. Not without papers. All they could do was wait to hear from her. Deming heard Leon say how he was wiring the loan shark Mama's payments, almost double what she'd been able to afford. At dinner, he snapped at Deming.
"Playing with your food again! No respect!"
But the next day, he took Deming out for donuts at the Vietnamese coffee shop, offered up maple glazed, powdered sugar, Boston cream.
"I spent 3 months on the boat coming over from Fujian," he said. "Washed with seawater. Slept on soggy cardboard. Think about your bed. Think about your bathroom. You can sleep."
Dumming concentrated on his donut. The cream oozing out. Where was the Boston? Like something obscene. On the boat, Leon said, the enforcers had nearly beaten a man to death for stealing a packet of instant ramen from the captain's quarters. One man had tried to stop the crew from doing something bad to a woman, and the enforcers kicked him in the face and threw him into the ocean. Leon could still hear that woman's screams. Deming licked cream off his fingers. "Mama came on a plane, not a boat." That night, Leon didn't come home until morning. Deming couldn't sleep, waking up every few hours to find the other side of the mattress still empty. When he heard Leon's voice in the hallway, he got up.
"Yipa, where were you?"
"Get out of the way. I need to go to bed."
"You smell like a bar," Vivian said. "Must be nice to stay out all night doing whatever you want. Wish I could do that."
"Go out all you want," Leon said. "I don't care."
"You don't care? Who cooks the meals? Who cleans up your garbage? Who washes your clothes? Who takes care of your Polly's son while you stay out all night drinking and pissing money away?"
Vivian picked up a pair of Leon's underwear and threw it at him.
"Wash your own panties. Find another girl to take care of this child."
"Will you be quiet?"
Vivian slammed the bathroom door and opened it so she could slam it again. Leon pushed past Dumming and fell onto the bed, landing on Mama's pillow. 10 days later, Leon was gone, left in the middle of the night. Vivian said he had gone to China. Michael started to cry.
"Is he coming back?"
"Not for a while. He found a job there, in our cousin's business. Lots of people going back these days."
"We're not going too, are we?"
Michael asked, and Vivian shook her head. It was like the time he fell off a swing and the wind got knocked out of him.
Boom!
Deming wanted to cry, but held it in, kept his face as still as possible. There was a rock inside him. A boulder. "He would have said goodbye," Vivian said. "But you and Dumming were sleeping. Deming knew this was bullshit. Leon had left because he was a coward. He hadn't said goodbye because he knew he shouldn't have left. And he had left because he felt bad. As Deming watched Vivian comfort Michael, a wall hardened around him. 3 weeks later, Vivian announced that she and Deming were going out. The two of them. They were going to buy new clothes for school.
"Why can't I come too?" Michael said. "I want new clothes."
Ever since Leon had left, Michael and Deming no longer bothered to walk past Sopheap's apartment or try to find change for Mr. Softy. They stayed inside, despite the heat. In the shower, Deming balled his fists up and hit his thighs. He had to pretend things were normal. "This is Deming and me time," Vivian said. "We never spend time together, right, Deming?"
"Michael should come too."
"I'm coming, Mom."
Vivian told Michael to stay inside the apartment.
"I'll be back soon."
"No, don't leave."
"Put the deadbolt on right away. I'll make you a nice dinner tonight."
Michael was crying again.
"Please don't leave."
"I'll be back very soon."
What about Deming?"
"We'll be back." Michael stopped crying. Vivian and Deming waited in the hallway, Vivian holding a plastic bag, until they heard the lock click shut. Deming heard a loud sniffle from inside the apartment and wanted to go back in, but Vivian was already walking toward the staircase. They got on the BX-12 bus, taking a pair of seats near the front. Deming wondered which stores they would go to.
"Face it," Vivian finally said. "Your mother isn't coming back, and you need a good family. I can't provide for both you and Michael right now." "I'm sorry, Deming. I don't have the money. I'm going to have to move to a smaller apartment. Get roommates. I'm getting people to look after you until Leon makes enough money in China so he can come back to New York. You'll be okay. And when Leon returns, we'll see each other again."
The wall tightened. He could barely breathe.
"When?" "Soon,"
Vivian said.
"How soon?"
Vivian didn't answer.
"I'll get a job! I'll be 12 in November!"
They got off on the Grand Concourse and entered an office building. He sat in a chair near the door as Vivian spoke to a woman in awkward English, her voice much softer than usual. He heard her say,
"I have his birth certificate."
The woman came over to him. She was tall and black. Her glasses had gold frames.
"Deming, why don't you wait in here while I talk to your aunt?"
She led him into a smaller office, with a folding table and ceiling fan, gave him crayons and a stack of coloring books, then reached into a drawer and handed him a box of apple juice and a bag of chips. "Here's a snack. You can draw if you want." The woman's smile was small but kind.
"I'll be back."
Deming opened a coloring book. It was for younger kids, with large outlines of animals, and most of the pages were already filled in. The crayons were all snapped in two. He scratched large X's over the faces of the animals and told himself Vivian would have the address of wherever he was going, that she and Michael would come get him in a few days. Maybe he'd get to go somewhere exciting, with video games. When the juice and chips were long gone, the woman came back, holding the plastic bag Vivian had been carrying.
"You're going to come with me now. We have a place for you to stay tonight. In Brooklyn."
He rode with a woman in a van, sitting up front, the bag on his lap. Inside were his clothes and toothbrush. They drove on a highway and across a bridge.